Good to be back with all of you tonight as we continue our series that we're looking at on navigating a secular age. If you weren't here for the lesson last night, what we talked about in that lesson was the reason for skepticism. Why is it that people forsake their knowledge of God and forsake worshiping the Lord? And oftentimes what a skeptic would like to say is that they are rational people that have been well-educated, and because of their education, that's why they don't believe. But it's us Christians who have emotional reasons for our unbelief. We've got emotional needs that we want to have filled in God, but once you get enlightened, you no longer need to have those things satisfied in that way. What you have now is just pure logic and reasoning. We detailed different reasons why people oftentimes are actually skeptical, and a lot of the causes of skepticism are rooted in some kind of emotion, either a sin that they want to commit, that they have an emotional tie towards, or it's a bad religious experience. Maybe they grew up in a hypocritical Christian family or something like that, or social pressure. And when you look at the causes, somebody might give these really intellectual-sounding arguments to try to say, this is why I'm not a believer. But if you peel back those intellectual arguments, what's oftentimes motivating those arguments is some kind of an emotional reaction to something they want or to something that they don't want. So we asked the question last night, if a lot of the folks that you know that are skeptic, or if in your own heart, you're thinking about pressing the eject button and getting away from God and His people, how do you reason with people in our culture today that are basing their skepticism off of some kind of an emotional thing? And this is where we get how Jesus would interact with people, like in John chapter 7, verse 37. We looked at a passage in John chapter 10 last night, but here's another one from the Gospel of John, where Jesus would say, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Notice that he's pleading with these people, not by giving them a list of a bunch of reasons why he's the Messiah. He's not giving them a list of all the reasons to trust the Bible. And there's a time and place for all those sorts of things. But what he's appealing to them for within this text is, you're thirsty. There are deep longings that you have within you that you know have not been satisfied by your sexual desires, like the woman at the well in John chapter 4, or by your power that you have, like Nicodemus in John chapter 3. And you can go on in the list of all the different kinds of things that people try to be fulfilled with. And one of the ways Jesus would draw people to himself is, I know that you've got deep needs, and I'm the one that can satisfy them. And so last night we just set up what we're doing for the rest of this weekend. But what we're going to be doing now is we're going to be looking at different deep, universal human needs and compare which worldview gives you what you need, the secular worldview or the Christian worldview. Meaning is one of the deep needs that we have. Viktor Frankl was a World War II psychoanalyst. He was brought into a concentration camp as a Jewish psychoanalyst. And once he was brought into a concentration camp, he kept doing his psychoanalyzing of people, and he wrote a book about it called Man's Search for Meaning. And this man became known as somebody who created something called logotherapy or logotherapy. And in his book, this is what he says logotherapy is. Regards its assignment as that of assisting the patient to find meaning in his life. What Viktor Frankl found in the concentration camps is that if somebody did not have any meaning in their life, or their meaning was being stripped away from them because of the concentration camp, those were the people that would lose hope and just literally die in their beds. After he got out of the concentration camps, he was helping people in his clinic try to find meaning in their life, because he knew without a sense of meaning in their life, they could not live in any kind of joyful way. And so I want you to ask yourself the question tonight, what is your meaning in life? And because we're in a church setting, we're supposed to say churchy things, so we know that the answer that you're supposed to say out loud is, God is my meaning in life. But ask yourself really functionally, what is the thing that your life is actually centered around? What are the things that you talk about more than anything else? What is it that you're finding your meaning in? And the way that you figure out what your meaning is, one of the ways, is it's how you would answer, this is why I'm on this earth. The word secular comes from the Latin word secularis, which means worldly or pertaining to an age or generation. When we talk about the secular approach to meaning versus the Christian approach to meaning, the word secular just means it's pertaining to this world. It's not thinking about eternal matters. So how would a secular person find meaning in life, and what are the problems with how they might try to find meaning, and then how do we contrast that with the biblical approach? So I want to show you a couple quotes, and I told you last night that whenever I've done these kinds of studies with atheists, I have a printout where I've got all these quotes from atheists that then move towards quotes from the Bible. So the first part of this lesson tonight, we're going to look at several quotes from atheists and how atheists say, this is how I try to find meaning in life. So here's one of them, a guy named Fabian Sushenik. He says this, the purpose of life must be the intention that the creator of life pursued with his creation. Now, unfortunately, there is no such creator in the atheist worldview. Thus, the notion of a purpose of life in the sense of the intention of a creator is undefined in the atheist world. For atheists, there is no God-given purpose in life. And this is one of the quotes that I've showed skeptics when I've studied with them, and they'll say, yeah, that's right, and I have other quotes that I'll use that make similar kinds of points that are a little bit more stark than what this guy's saying here. But they'll say, yeah, we don't have any kind of objective meaning in life. There is no God that created everything, and the only way that we would have an objective meaning in life is if one was assigned to us from something outside of myself by a God that said, this is what you must do. And so I remember the first time studying with a group of skeptics, and I was showing them quotes like this, and I said, do you guys agree with these quotes? And they said, yeah, that's right, there is no meaning in life. And I've never heard somebody just outright admit that. But they like quotes like these, and they agree with that. But does this suggest that a skeptic would not try to find some kind of meaning in life? There's no objective meaning for them, but do they still try to find meaning in life in some way, and how would they do that? Look at this quote from Adam Rutherford, where he says, a meaningless universe, so he's accepting that the universe is meaningless, there's no God that's given it meaning. A meaningless universe does not mean that we live our lives without purpose. I'm an atheist, but I try to live my life replete with purpose. Be kind, learn and discover as much as you can, share that knowledge, relieve suffering when you can, have tonnes, he's British, have tonnes of fun. That's why it's not pointless. We have the power to create life and to show those lives wonder. Surely that's enough. It is for me. All right. How does Adam Rutherford, this atheist, who's got a famous podcast, I guess, how does he tell people that him as a skeptic, this is how I find my meaning in life? You know, there's no God that's assigned meaning in my life. That's fine because I like to be kind to people. There's a lot of mean people in this world. Have you ever noticed that? You just go to like Starbucks and you'll see it. The person in front of you or the barista or whatever, and everybody's thinking that everybody else is mean. Isn't it nice to be that kind of person that walks in? And I'm the kind person, and I just brighten somebody's day. I get a lot of meaning out of that. So that's one thing that he suggests here. How about learning and discovering new things and then sharing that knowledge with other people? You guys like to read books. You like to listen to podcasts. Learning things is cool. The History Channel, all that sort of thing. Until I get to the ancient alien stuff, and that's just kind of weird. But in so much as that you're learning real things, don't you like to share that kind of stuff with other people? I mean, that gives your life meaning. Or how about relieve suffering when you can? You ever known somebody that was emotionally wounded? You never knew somebody that was physically in pain or financially in pain in some way? And to be the person to be able to help them and to relieve that kind of pain, that's a great thing. What about having tonnes of fun? Tonnes of fun is a lot of fun. Having fun is fun. And so you can try to have a lot of meaning based on all the fun things that you can do, fun movies, fun times with friends, theme parks, playing sports, whatever, all those kinds of fun things. Now, before I say anything further about this, I just want you to challenge yourself and ask yourself, You're a Christian sitting here tonight. Is this functionally how you derive meaning in life? You might say that you're a Christian, but is there anything about your life that's really distinct from advice like this? That really shows that my life is about a lot more than just being kind, learning, relieving suffering, having fun. Does your life show that your meaning goes beyond what a secular atheist would say? And that's, I just think, something that we all need to be honest with ourselves about. But I've shown this quote to skeptics, and they really like this one. They say, yes, that's right. That's what I would do to try to find meaning in my life. All right, so this is the secular approach to it. There's no objective meaning, but I can find meaning for myself, and it's in whatever I decide my meaning in life will be. And these are some examples of the kinds of things that give my life meaning. So what are some of the weaknesses to the secular approach? And the reasons that I want to talk about the flaws of this approach is, number one, to challenge you to ask yourself, am I trying to find my meaning in God, or is it in this, basically? But also, you might have people in your life that are not right with God, that are not trying to seek after God, and maybe some of these things that we'll say will help you know some things you can bring up in a conversation with them. But here's the first weakness of this approach. This approach cannot apply to everybody in the world. So the stuff that that Rutherford brought up, can everyone learn and discover and share things with other people? Can everybody relieve suffering? And can everybody have tones of fun? The only reason that he can bring up those things is because he's in a place of privilege. He's in a place where he's got wealth. He's in a place where he's got freedom. Can you imagine if Dr. Adam Rutherford went up to somebody in India that, I remember distinctly Barry Kircheville telling me this story when he went to India, of a man that was on the side of the road looking for handouts from people. And he had no arms and no legs. So people would carry this guy to this spot, and he had a hat or a jacket or something. And somebody had to set all of it up for him, obviously. Could you imagine Adam Rutherford going up to this guy and going, hey, yeah, there's no meaning in life, but what you should try to focus on is learning and discovering things and sharing all the great things that you learn, guy with no limbs. And how about you try to relieve suffering whenever you can do that? And just, you know, buck up and have tones of fun. There's a lot of things that are really enjoyable in the. If your worldview can't apply to everybody in the world, it's not a good worldview. It's not a good way of looking at the world. It's not a good way of recommending to other people that this is how you should look at the world. So that's the maybe the most obvious first weakness with this approach. But the second weakness with this approach is that it's vexing to think about. It's vexing to think about. Leo Tolstoy wrote War and Peace, a famous Russian author, lived in the 1800s, and a very successful guy. Like, he was part of the back then version of Hollywood. Everybody knew about this guy, very famous man. Everybody respected him. He was healthy and wealthy, all that, all the kind of stuff that people would be envious of. He wrote a short book called Confessions. And in his book, Confessions, he details his exodus from a secular worldview and his entryway into a more biblical worldview. I don't know what all of his biblical convictions were. I don't know anything about what he thought about salvation. But he at least got to a point where he believed in God and he believed in the Bible. I want to show you something that he wrote that kept bothering him, that caused him eventually to become some kind of a believer in the Bible. So look at what this quote is here. I could give no reasonable meaning to any single action or to my whole life. Sooner or later, my affairs, whatever they may be, will be forgotten and I shall not exist. Then why go on making any effort? How can man fail to see this? And how go on living? That is what is surprising. One can only live while one is intoxicated with life. As soon as one is sober, it is impossible not to see that it is all a mere fraud and a stupid fraud. That is precisely what it is. There is nothing either amusing or witty about it. It is simply cruel and stupid. What is it that Tolstoy found frustrating? If you were to ask Leo Tolstoy, hey, that garden that you have in your backyard, that single action that you just went out there to go water the garden, what was the meaning of that? He said, I don't know really what the meaning of that was. Why is it that I put those shoes on and not another pair of shoes? I don't know the meaning of anything, if he thought about it deeply. And I don't even know the meaning to my whole life. I can't give you an answer to little things that I do during the day, and I can't give you an answer to my whole life. And when I die, everything's going to be gone. It's just going to be stench and worms. So he asks himself this question, why go on making any effort? Do you notice that whenever he thought deeply about meaning in life, when he was more of a secular kind of person, when he thought deeply about these kinds of questions, it drove him to despair and it drove him to depression. But notice that he says that one can only live while one is intoxicated with life. What does he mean by that? He's saying, yeah, as long as you're not thinking deeply about anything and you live like a drunk person. He's not talking about literally being drunk. Intoxicated people don't think deeply about anything, though. And so what he's saying here is, yeah, as long as I can just, you know, not think deeply about anything, nobody's going to prod me to think deeply about anything, I can try to kind of be happy with all the things that I have. But as soon as I start thinking deeply about things, then here comes the depression and the despair again. Have you ever thought about what the word amusement means? To muse, M-U-S-E, means to think deeply about something. What's the prefix A mean? So somebody who is theistic believes in God. Somebody who is atheistic is without God. So to muse means to think deeply. What is amusement? To not think deeply about anything. Have you seen how in our culture we're really good at amusement? Like we are scrolling on our phones, we see cats flushing toilets, and that's really cool. And then there's another video that shows up. And our culture and our technology is training us to live in an intoxicated kind of life, where we're not thinking deep about anything. But for the people that do have moments when they wake up in the middle of the night, or they have got a moment of clarity, and they're asking themselves these deep questions, it's troubling. Do you know, by the way, what skeptics do with this? Skeptics will say, yeah, it is troubling to think about how everything is just going to burn up one day and it's all going to be gone and over. Do you know what skeptics say their advice is to you, though, about that? Look what Will Storr says. We know how this ends. You're going to die, and so will everyone you love. Human life, in all its noise and hubris, will be rendered meaningless for eternity. The cure for the horror is story. Our brains distract us from this terrible truth by filling our lives with hopeful goals and encouraging us to strive for them. It gives our existence the illusion of meaning and turns our gaze from the dread. Here's what Will Storr says. All right, we all know that if we think deeply about what's going to end up happening, you're going to die, there's going to be no remembrance of you, there's no consciousness after death. We all know that, so what we have to do is distract ourselves with stories. This is interesting to me, and this is one of the points that I'll bring up with skeptics when I study with them, is I'll say, you guys try to present yourselves as those who think deeply about things. But your worldview is telling you, the people that support your worldview tell you, don't think deeply about questions like this. Distract yourself, amuse yourself with other things, and maybe some of the less lethal forms of amusement would be, you know, like your phone and scrolling, and not that that's a great thing. But do you know why a lot of people use drugs? Viktor Frankl, the guy that we started with, look what he says about drugs. The drug scene is one aspect of a more general mass phenomenon, namely the feeling of meaninglessness resulting from a frustration of our existential needs. I've studied the scriptures with lots of people that have used drugs. I've studied the scriptures with people that were part of drug cartels. And if I ask them questions like, why did you ever use drugs? Every time, it's to dull something. To dull me from the deep realities of things that I don't want to have to think about. To dull me so I can cope with all the... there's a little bit of a side tangent. Do you know what happens to you if you start using drugs, let's say when you're 13 or 14 or 15? And let's say that you're using drugs for 20 years. And now you're in your mid-30s, Do you know what your emotional maturity level is? It's still a 13 or a 14-year-old. You have cryogenically frozen your growth because every time something difficult came into your life, you went to dull yourself and you never learned how to deal with anything that was difficult. But one of the things that drives people to stuff like this is I've got no meaning in life and I don't want to have to think about any of these kinds of things. All right, so do you see how this is a problem for this worldview? If it's vexing to think about that there's no meaning, ultimate meaning in life. And if your worldview says that one of the things you have to do to deal with that reality is go use drugs or go amuse yourself with stories or something like that, and it's telling you don't think deeply, do you think that's a good worldview? Especially when it comes to questions that people want answers to all over the world. So that's the second problem with this. Now, somebody might say, well, I'm just not a deep thinker, and I can get on all my life thinking like an intoxicated person, so I'm happy, happy, happy. I just don't think deeply about anything. There's still another problem with this worldview, and that is that suffering will come. Look at what Bertrand Russell says here. For the young, there is nothing unattainable, a good thing desired with the whole force of a passionate will, and yet impossible is to them not credible. Yet by death, by illness, by poverty, or by the voice of duty, we must learn, each one of us, that the world was not made for us, and that however beautiful may be the things we crave, fate may nevertheless forbid them. Notice how he starts this quote here. Do you know what young people believe? He's saying here, for the young, there's nothing unattainable. So if you're a young person, you think, I can become whatever I want to become. If I put enough work into things, we can change society. I can achieve whatever it is that I want to do. I can have a nice house. I can have a respectable family, all that sort of thing. I will just make it my goal, and I'll get all the things that I want. And I'm still young, so I got all these years ahead of me. But Bertrand Russell goes on, and he's, again, another atheist, to burst that bubble here. And he says that there's several things that are going to cause you to realize that you're not going to get everything in life that you thought you were going to get. Death. Now, it could be your death, and it strips you away from all the things you were building your meaning on, or it could be the death of somebody else. So I'm married with four kids. Let's say that my meaning in life was built around my family. And I'm not with them, but they get into a car wreck and all of them die in a tragic car wreck. Do you realize how fragile your meaning in life could be if it's built off of the relationships you have with other people? Should they be fulfilling relationships? Absolutely. But are they the basis for your meaning in life? No, they can't be. What about illness? Have you ever seen from time to time athletes or musicians or people that start to have the deterioration of the body or some illness that they got that has permanently affected? I know Eric Clapton had some problems recently where he can't play the guitar like he used to be able to play it or something like that. Where you got people that use their body for different kinds of things that they find meaning in, and one day some kind of illness or just even aging can strip that away from you. Remember one time when I was preaching at a little church in Minnesota, there was a man that came up to me. These were his words, not mine. And he said, hey, Eric, do you know why there's so many old, cranky people? And I said, no, but can you please tell me, because I don't want to end up like that. And he quoted Ecclesiastes 12, and he talked about people who didn't remember their creator in the days of their youth. Because then that text goes on to talk about the deterioration of the body. Your arms can't do the things that they used to do. Your legs can't do those kinds of, you can't hear as well anymore. You try to make your meaning in life based on what you hear, the music that you like. You try to make it based off the things you do with your legs, sports that you play, whatever. There's all kinds of things that as you get older or you get illnesses will be stripped away from you. And so if you didn't remember your creator in the days of your youth and you built your meaning around all those things, age strips it away and it leaves you cranky. But if God was always the center and then some of those things are taken from your life, oh yeah, that's kind of a bummer, but I still have my God. And that's what I've always been most passionate about. So you see, illness can take... What about poverty? Poverty, am I going to build my life based on having a lot of money and then the stock market crashes and all these bank things that are happening that I don't understand and what all that means? Then the last one, the voice of duty. This is the one that I've seen happen most with young people. You say you got a young person that says, well, I'm going to make it big by being a YouTube star. I'm going to have a YouTube channel, and I'm going to make millions and billions of dollars on YouTube, or I'm going to get a TikTok channel that everybody's going to follow, or if it's not that, I'm going to be like a musician, and I'm going to make it big being a musician. And then, so you're pursuing that with everything you got, and you think that you're going to make it, and then eventually the voice of duty comes. You know what the voice of duty is? You've got bills that you've got to pay, like financial bills. And you're not making money doing all these things that you thought you were going to do. The voice of duty will come alongside you and say, it's not what you thought it was going to be. And so thank you, Bertrand Russell, for bursting that bubble. But here's a review of the weaknesses of the secular approach. The first one, it can't apply to everybody. The second one, it's vexing and even depressing when you think deeply about the fact that you have no meaning in life. And then thirdly, this last one is that suffering will come. And when suffering comes, it will strip you away from the things you've built your meaning off of. All right. So, do you see how that's the secular approach? Those are the weaknesses to it. What's the biblical approach? Because this exercise is not just, hey, if you're a secular person, if this is how you're building your meaning, you're probably feeling pretty bad right now. But what is it that God offers us that's much better than this? When Jesus would say things like, if anybody's thirsty, come to me and drink. Can you see why people would be thirsting if they're trying to find their meaning in life based on things like this? What's the biblical approach? The first part of the biblical approach is to say something about the first thing that the Bible says about human beings. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. What does it mean to be made in God's image? I remember as a new Christian, that was one of the questions that I would ask people, and people had a lot of different kinds of responses and thoughts about that. Maybe one thing that would be helpful to do is to look up in the Bible where else that word image is used. And one of those other times that you see the word image is in Numbers 33, verse 52, where it says, you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their metal images and demolish all their high places. And this is one of many other passages that uses this same Hebrew word to talk about the false idols that people worshipped. So the pagans, they would build temples, and in their temples they would have an image of the god that they couldn't see. You remember Dagon, the one that falls prostrate before the Ark of the Covenant that the Philistines had? So they would put images in their temples. God told the Israelites, don't make any images of me. And if we were to go around the room and I was to ask you this very restrictive question. So here's the restrictive question. We're going to get somebody in this city to make an image of God. But it has to be one animal that you think of. What animal would you pick? And some people, oh, I like the idea of a lamb because lambs are like gentle and soft and Jesus, like, I picture him that way. And then like some other guy that's into guns and trucks would say, well, I'm going to think about him as like a bull with big horns because he's powerful. And then somebody else might come up with like a silverback gorilla because they're really strong and God's strong and all this kind of thing. And people would have all kinds of debates. What's the problem with making an image of God that's carved out of wood or stone? Because it only ever goes like this. You see the point? The image only can tell you one aspect, kind of what it's trying to represent. It can't move. It doesn't have feelings. It can't have arms that it moves, nothing like that. It's just a piece of stone or a piece of metal. So the one thing that God created that can adequately image him and represent him and be a picture of him are human beings. Do you see the dignity that gives you? You know what an image is a picture of somebody. It's not literally the person, but it's a reflection of the person, like on your license plate or your driver's license or whatever. It's an image of you. God created the world, and he wanted it to be filled with images of him that were reflectors of his character. Of all the things God made, of all the wonderful animals he made, you are what God created that was dignified enough to be able to image him. Of all the things he made, human beings are the most like God. And this, by the way, applies to you no matter how many limbs you have, no matter what skin color you are, no matter how much money you have, no matter what level of education you are, everybody is made in God's image. So practically speaking, then, how does that give me meaning? Well, if I'm supposed to be a reflection of God, and that's what my mission is to, when people see my character, they see the character of God, that means that my meaning is to draw near and to know God. How can I reflect somebody that I don't know? How can I imitate somebody that I've not taken the time to get to know? When you read your Bibles, are you asking yourself the question, what does this teach me about God? Our culture right now is so inundated with psychology and self-help. There's a book, by the way, by Paul Vitz that's titled Psychology as Self-Worship, which is an interesting idea. That sometimes when people get all into personality tests and they get all into psychology and all these kinds of things, it's possible that that's a form of self-worship because you're really focused on yourself and all of that. Do we ever study the Bible in that way, like it's a self-help manual, or I'm going to study the Bible just to see why everybody else is wrong, and there's times that we got to refute false doctrine, but if what we're not chiefly doing is, what is this teaching me about God so that I can be amazed by him and I can try to reflect him? That's part of what our meaning in life is. So, we were made in God's image, and that says something about what our purpose is. But then, if one of the weaknesses of the secular approach is that suffering will strip your meaning away from you, because if you build your meaning in things in this life will tear things away from you, does suffering remove the purpose of the Christian? Look at what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. In this you rejoice, talking about this salvation that's reserved for them that he talks about earlier. So in this salvation you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Peter says here that you guys are being grieved by various trials. What would be some of those trials? Well, they've been scattered from their homeland, so they're experiencing economic uncertainties. They've been stripped away from their jobs. A lot of people right now in our culture are wondering if we're headed towards the Great Depression 2.0 or whatever. You worried about that kind of thing? Throughout the book, these people are being spoken against as evildoers, maligned. You ever had somebody ruin your reputation before? In chapter 3, they're having marriage problems. How many people get into marriage thinking that this will be the fulfillment of my meaning in life, this person? And then they start having marriage problems, and it's not what they expected it to be. These people are going through a lot of difficult things, and I want to point out that in verse 6, Peter says, you guys are being grieved by these things. Have you ever... I'll just tell you a story. There was one time when I was in college in Minnesota going to the community school that I was at, and there was a religious girl at my school that I was getting to know. And we parked at the same time and we were walking into the school together. And the night before was like World War III with my parents. Printing out articles from atheist websites, why you can't trust the Bible. Every time we had dinner, it was just them pummeling me about what I was believing in, that sort of thing. And so I didn't sleep well that night. I'm walking into the school, this religious girl's next to me, and she says, so how are you doing? And I said, you know, honestly, I'm just not doing good right now. And she looked at me like this, and she said, every day should be joyful in the Lord. Okay. Have you ever known Christians like that? Do you notice that Peter says here that you guys are being grieved? Christians being grieved? The tears are real? The pain is real? Yeah, all of that's really happening in your life, but this grief that's tearing you to pieces right now? Is it stripping away your meaning in life? You audience that have been stripped away from your job and your home that maybe was a really beautiful home and you had all these things that organized exactly like you wanted. You guys are really going through a lot of difficulties. Is it taking away from your meaning in life? No, because look what's happening through all of this. Your faith is compared to gold that perishes, but it's being tested by fire. So if you, this is a weird thing to think about, but if you had a piece of gold that could talk to you, and you could talk to this little piece of gold and said, hey, Mr. Gold or Mrs. Gold, would you like to be purified? And Mr. or Mrs. Gold says, yeah, sure, I'd like to be purified. I want to be refined as much as I can. You're like, okay, cool, put it in the furnace. And then Mr. or Mrs. Gold says, why are you doing that? That really hurts me. You go, yeah, well, this is, you said you wanted to be purified. Purified into what? More and more into the image of the one that created us. For the world, suffering and trials and economic collapse and the death of loved ones, those things all strip you away from your meaning in life. But for the Christian, it drives us deeper into it. You know, in the times in your life where you've suffered the most are the times that you relied the most on God and you were the most transformed. In James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, suffering turbocharges your faith and your growth. Let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be mature, lacking nothing. Do you see how nothing in this life that can harm us can ever take away our meaning in life to be imagers of God? Now, one final thing about the biblical approach to meaning is good news about Judgment Day. In the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is trying to find meaning apart from God. He is doing this experiment where he's trying to find fulfillment apart from God. And at the end of the book, if you just isolate just these two verses without thinking about the context of the whole book, these verses seem really ominous and scary, and certainly there's something to be scared of in these verses. But in the flow of thought of the book of Ecclesiastes, these verses are good news. They're actually a relief. Look at Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Solomon realized that without God, there was no meaning in life. He talks about wise people and wealthy people that die and nobody remembers anything about them. But then he surfaces at the end of the book and says, ah, but everything matters. If I'm gardening, it matters. The way that I treat the waitress or the waiter matters. The way that I drive my car matters. The way that I conduct my emotions, even in my family when it's not around church people. Everything matters now because there's a judgment day. God's going to bring every secret thing into judgment. Do you remember what Leo Tolstoy said? I could give no reason for any single action I did or to my whole life. But then, Ecclesiastes, everything that you do will be held accountable one day. And suddenly that means everything I do is infused with meaning. Because I have to bring those things before God one day. It's not an ominous thing in the book of Ecclesiastes that he says this. This is a relief because without Judgment Day, there would not be ultimate meaning in life. Do you see Judgment Day is good news in that way? And it's not just when the Lord returns, we have to answer for everything. What is it that 1 John chapter 3, verse 2 says about those who are in Christ? Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. We've just been trying to be images of God, but one day we will see him face to face, and we're going to be transformed to be like him. Every time you grow in your character, every time you become more patient, every time you become more loving, you're getting closer and closer to being a more accurate image of God, but it's still never perfected in this life. And one day, because of Judgment Day, you will be made into a perfect imager of God. And all the things that you strove for in this life will reach their final fulfillment. You will one day get the full experience of what you are seeking in this life if you're a Christian. What is the biblical approach? You are created to be an imager of God. And it's something that suffering can never take you away from. Suffering drives you deeper into that meaning. And judgment day means that everything that we do matters. Can you see why whenever Leo Tolstoy couldn't go to bed at night and he would think deeply about, does anything really matter, why it would drive him to despair? In your life, is being an imager of God something that is your primary meaning? Or have you been trying to functionally fulfill your meaning by all kinds of things in this life that age or some kind of disaster can strip away from you? This is the Loctite approach to meaning in life. Nothing can take it away from you. And if you're building your meaning on anything else, it will eventually be stripped away from you, and you will be left heartbroken because of it. If there's anybody here tonight that's not been serving God as they need to, we're about to sing this song, "There is Power in the Blood." There's power in the blood to relieve your burdens. There's power in the blood to give you hope. There's power in the blood to make you new again.